Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
Oh boy, we got some news.
I can't believe we had to split our news episode into two episodes. There's so much to cover.
Yeah, so what we decided to do, you're getting a bonus episode this week. So this is episode 2 of 3 for the week. Our first episode, which we recorded on Tuesday, published on Wednesday, was an interview with Sean Alexander Allen about his life in the industry, his new game, Treachery and Beatdown City. We had some honest conversations about diversity and inclusion in the industry. And this is our regularly scheduled news show. We're recording this Thursday afternoon. And immediately after we finish this, we're going to record a bonus episode because it's earnings season and there is so much to digest. So Amanda made the great suggestion of splitting the earnings out. And we'll do this in the future, I think. We'll keep the earnings show a separate show because there is just so much. And it might be two shows because we know last week we covered a bunch of earnings as well.
For sure. So the earnings stuff is, we think it's really important for the context of the industry, but also not everybody cares about what AAA companies are up to, publicly traded AAA companies are up to in terms of their finances. You are going to want to pay attention to this next episode, though. There is some serious shenanigans going on in the industry right now.
And we'll talk on that episode a little bit more about our philosophy and how we're going to cover earnings. But for now, we've got some news to do and we have some stuff to close the loop on. There were two stories that we talked about on last week's news show that we wanted to revisit.
Absolutely. So what's the first one?
The first one, going back to that hour-long Unreal Engine 5 reveal interview with Jeff Keighley, discussing that. During that session, Tim Sweeney, head of Epic, said, "The world of loading screens is over." Now, we've heard this before. Throughout this industry, we know that the PlayStation 5 was one of the very first things we heard about the PlayStation 5 was
the solid-state hard drive.
Solid-state hard drive is going to reduce and likely eliminate loading times, which is going to change design.
It's absolutely going to change design. I mean, how many times have we sat in loading screens throughout our lives as gamers, you know, or in an elevator or squeezing through a cavern or whatever? Mm-hmm. Loading times have been a significant chunk of how we deal with games.
Yeah, there are two different ways that we typically experience them. One is that interstitial, you get tooltips, you get some kind of background as something's loading in. Sometimes you learn something. A lot of the time, it's stuff you already know. The other thing that you get, and this is my personal favorite, it doesn't happen that often, in Spider-Man, you got Spidey on the subway doing weird things, like checking his phone or looking at another Spider-Man. That was great. So, but one of the things you did mention was the in-game loading masking that happens. And that's the Mass Effect elevator, right?
Exactly. Or the Tomb Raider squeeze through to the next portion of the dungeon.
And that is exactly what we wanted to talk about today.
Exactly.
So in that demo, that was a playable demo that was running on PlayStation 5, there was a moment where the main character was squeezing through a wall. Now, savvy gamers, those of us who are tuned in, and this is consumers as well, have gotten used to understanding what those squeezes through caverns are. Those are masking loading, for the next area of the game.
Yeah, they don't typically take all that long. It's a couple of seconds, but it's just enough time to load textures and to load lighting and everything like that for the next piece of wherever it is that you are in a game. Yep.
So seeing that in a demo alongside a statement that the era of loading times is over was really interesting. So it was Kotaku that reached out to Epic and got a statement. And this is what Epic said. "The actual goal of that part was to force the player camera to be really close to the wall to show how much detail there is in the scene. We're not trying to hide any loading, but actually show good-looking assets in a close-up." I think it was a miscalculation.
I think so, too. I think that by choosing something that has been universally understood as a mechanism to disguise loading, I mean, we've seen it enough times in Tomb Raider, especially in Tomb Raider's reboot. Mm-hmm. Right? So
it was in Jedi Fallen Order all over the place as well. Another game built on UE4. But here's the thing. I don't think it was a miscalculation in terms of what they were trying to show.
No.
I think it's that there is so much skepticism amongst consumers. And again, this goes back to everything that we were talking about last week, which was this was not a consumer-focused presentation, but it was billed and promoted to consumers as if it was. And that created so much tension. That created some issue between console wars. Yeah, there was a lot of dissonance.
It was a lot of dissonance there, and it really did stoke the console wars. And so that's another piece of the loop that we want to close today. Mm-hmm. So on Tim Sweeney's Twitter on May 15th, so 6 days ago, he ended up clarifying a little bit about the UE5 demo. So this is what he had to say on Twitter. The Unreal Engine 5 demo on PlayStation 5 was the culmination of years of discussions between Sony and Epic on future graphics and storage architectures. The Nanite and Lumen tech powering it will be fully supported on both PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X and will be awesome on both.
Okay. So the important part of that is the fact that it'll be supported. The how awesome, so awesome stuff is...
How awesome, so awesome. Yeah,
it's normal fluff. But the fact that it will run and work as we saw on Xbox Series X should make people happy and comfortable across the board.
And of course, it's going to be absolutely gorgeous on PC as well.
Mm-hmm. The last bit of Epic news, because we had a whole bunch of stuff in addition to the UE5 stuff last week, is that Fortnite has surpassed $1 billion in spending on the App Store alone.
That's just the App Store.
Just the App Store. So mobile Fortnite is really powerful. We know that Call of Duty Mobile is doing really well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So mobile as a way to engage with core experiences is becoming more and more prevalent, more and more common. I think we're never going to see the mobile stigma completely on the way, you know, thrown to the wayside.
No.
But this goes a long way to showing, like, hey, that loud minority that says that mobile games aren't real games, they're just that. They're a loud vocal minority. They do not represent the global population of players that is spending this kind of money on a game like Fortnite.
Absolutely. I think it's important to recognize that there are still households out there that only have tablets and they only have phones, so mobile gaming is all they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that by completely disregarding this significant section of the population is really disingenuous and, quite frankly, myopic.
It may not be the way things are here in North America, but we know that there are big sections of the world where mobile gaming is enormous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And dwarfs other forms of gaming. There was one other story that we wanted to come back to. The culling.
Oh, the culling.
Now, first, I want to issue a correction because there was some confusion because of the culling's path. The game was originally released, I believe, as a premium game. Its second iteration was free to play. I mistakenly said last week that this new version was free to play. That's not accurate.
Oh, okay.
So the situation is this. If you've ever played the culling, it's free for you now.
Okay.
So if you played it in its free to play iteration, then you've got it.
Okay.
If you've never played The Culling on Xbox One, and it's only on Xbox One right now, you will have to pay $5.99 to get the game.
Okay.
So it's a $6 game. Now, the other thing is, that's where I made an error last week.
Got it.
All right, so I wanted to correct that first. They have since also updated that model. Remember last week we talked about how you were getting one online
so
play
confusing.
A day? But you could play offline games.
Right. So what's the update there?
The update there is they've increased the number of tokens to 10 per day. So you can play 10 online games per day.
Okay.
Assuming you don't win any of them, you don't pay anything, whatever, you get 10 games per day.
That seems a little more reasonable.
Sure. Plus, if you play an offline match and you win an offline match against the bots, you also get an online play.
Okay. So that makes a little bit more sense. The business model there is still not great.
And you and I talked about this, that there was a lot of confusion around this. PC Gamer had a really good story. They talked to Josh Van Veld, who is the director of operations at Xavient, and here are some quotes from him. In retrospect, it was really obvious that one was not going to give us the flow of players. But you have to remember, we were kind of terrified of everybody coming back, overloading the servers, costing us a ton of money, and not spending anything. So we were afraid to turn that dial. Now, this is the issue, and this is what people often forget about online games. Launching an online game is a balancing act. You don't want to overpurchase server space, right?
Exactly. And you also run into the problem where you won't necessarily know what that server load is going to look like until you open the gates. But opening the gates could crash your servers. It means that you need to buy more servers, or you bought too many because there's not enough people. It is so nerve-wracking. I do not ever in my life want to launch an online game.
Yeah, and this reminds me of the problems that Friday the 13th ran into when it first launched.
That was tough.
Now, Xeviant came by this fear, honestly, because when they relaunched the game the second time, so this was the free-to-play iteration, here's what Van Veld had to say. We onboarded 1 million new players very quickly, which was overwhelming in some ways, and at the time, we didn't have visibility right away into their spending habits and everything else. So this is a metrics and telemetry issue, as well as understanding how people were going to purchase things in the game.
Well, but that's a key thing to remember in a lot of these, you know, freemium-ish games, these free-to-play-ish games, is that data drives everything. Mm-hmm. Analytics drive every single decision. They have to.
Yeah, so the second half of that quote was, it took us a while to kind of realize what the monetization looked like relative to our AWS costs, but we were spending tens of thousands of dollars every month. So that's their server. That's ensuring that they had enough servers for everybody.
Right.
So they ramped up very quickly. It was fully free to play.
Yeah.
People jumped back in because the original culling was really interesting. It was a more melee-focused battle royale game. So in summary here, he says, we tried the model of getting huge and we couldn't afford to make it work. I think if we were backed by a big publisher, remember they're an independent developer, and had deeper pockets, when we had all of those original free-to-play players, we probably could have done something with it, but we were not equipped to ride that storm out for 6 months and then grow it.
That's tough. That's a really tough situation to be in, because if you can't, it's one of those situations where you can't bootstrap yourself out of that problem.
Right. And at the same time, I look at this and go, there was probably a lot of fear. We know that they launched The Culling. It didn't do well. They launched The Culling 2. I think that game came down within a week or two because it just wasn't well received.
Yeah.
And then they relaunched The Culling Origins free to play. Mm-hmm. And they were assuming the worst. I think they were prepared for the worst, that people weren't going to come in and play. But they made this classic mistake that they didn't prepare for success. And this is a lot of some things that businesses go through. It's not a great problem to have. It's not the worst problem to have. But if you can't, if you launch and you're in demand and you can't service all the people who are knocking at your door saying, hey, we want to buy your product or play your game, then you lose them very quickly. And there's a good chance they might not come back.
And they'll tell their friends, oh, hey, if you're thinking about playing this game or purchasing this product, they're not ready, so you are better off going elsewhere.
Yeah, just wait.
Just wait 6 months until they really get their sea legs.
And this is the thing. Not everybody is Blizzard with the ability to essentially remake Diablo 3. Not everybody is Square Enix with the ability to remake Final Fantasy 14. And not everybody is Bethesda with the ability to remake Fallout 76.
It's the same kind of thing with Ubisoft's approach to its year 2 live service games. Not everyone has those deep pockets and that plethora of talent just waiting to be assigned these tasks of redesigning enormous systems so that they work better for players. If you're an independent developer with an online game, that is a hefty headache.
Yep.
I do not envy Xeviant any of the headache that they've had. And it's nice to see those comments and that kind of honesty. So good on PC Gamer for getting that comment.
Yep, and good on Xeviant for really making some rapid adjustments. They saw the blowback on their business model, made some adjustments. I think it is far more reasonable now, and you can buy those, you know, 1 day passes or 7 day passes. You want to go in and play with a friend for one night and just play unlimited matches all night long? Yeah, you can spend a couple of bucks. It's not that expensive. So
to each their own. It's one of those things where gaming has become a thing where you have a game or a couple of games that you play on a regular basis, and that's it, right? Especially on the multiplayer angle. For us, we have a handful of them, but we also grew up in a different age, in a different era of like, wow, we have a lot of games to play.
Yeah, we do.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
It is true. All right, so we have one more thing to close the loop on. Gamescom now has a full schedule for its digital event.
Which is amazing. I'm actually kind of excited about digital Gamescom because I've never gone to Gamescom. So it'll
it's a good time. It's a lot of work, but it's a good time.
It seems like a really interesting show. So anyway, it's going to be 4 days. On August 27th, it's opening night live with Jeff Keighley. On August 28th, it's Gamescom's daily show, highlights, promoting partners, Gamescom Studio, which is interviews with developers, partner content, and DevCom.
Yes.
DevCom is super important.
Yes, and that was, so Gamescom used to be, it used to be a full week where you had GDC Europe and then Gamescom. DevCom is like PAX Dev. It is kind of like GDC. It is very developer focused, obviously.
Right, but it's a much lighter version of it. And it's mostly, from what I understand, it's very much so centered around networking.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So now that that's on August 28th. 29th is everything from the 28th, plus an awesome indies program putting a spotlight on indie games. I love this idea. We love indie games. So I'm really glad to see that European indies are going to be able to get the kind of coverage that they deserve.
And indies often get swallowed at Gamescom just like they do at E3. If you've never been to Gamescom, and I assume that some of our listeners haven't, The Köln Messe is huge. I believe it's 10, 11, 12 halls, something like that. Now, I don't think two of those
halls... It's like a bajillion times bigger than the LACC.
Yeah, it's enormous. and that's kind of the way they grow them in Europe, because I think Berlin has one that's like just as big.
Wild.
Maybe it's just a Germany thing. But so those halls, when you go in, are as big as South or West at the LA Convention Center. And there are a bunch of them, and it's elbow-to-elbow people. The sanity in that space is the business center, which is two halls that are right across essentially a large open area, like a large corridor. And that is a delightful place to be during Gamescom. But you stand at the top of that escalator, and you've probably seen pictures
of it.
Just like, it looks like Dead Rising in there.
It's upsetting.
And quite frankly, if they were to hold Gamescom this year, it would probably be Dead Rising in there.
Okay, so we definitely are super glad that Gamescom is going to be online. So indies tend to get swallowed up at these big events. It's really nice to see them put a spotlight on what I'm assuming is going to be a ton of amazing European indies. There's some cool developers out there that are doing some really amazing stuff.
Absolutely.
On the 30th is going to be Daily Show, DevCom, Gamescom Studio, partner content, and Best of Show. Which includes the presentation of the Gamescom Awards.
And usually while I was there, I was so busy, like, I don't know if there was an awards ceremony. I don't know that there was. It was just like, we would get the email like, okay, this game won Best of Show. It's like, okay, cool.
It's a thing that happens.
Because E3, with Judges Week and everything, you don't usually find out until a couple of weeks after.
Yeah.
So that's not, it's different. So at Gamescom, you always find out
GDC is probably the closest comparison, because they do the GDC awards during GDC.
Yes.
Which I still have never been to.
The GDC awards.
The GDC awards. I've been to GDC a couple times.
Yeah. So that is all of our old business, closing the loop on some stuff. Now on to new business.
I love that it took us almost 20 minutes to get to the new stuff.
Whew.
Ooh, there's a lot going on. Okay. So let's start off on something that I have been following for quite some time, which is what the heck is going on with System Shock? There's a new System Shock that's supposed to be coming out, and this is a very challenging story. It's a challenging story to talk about because of everything that went down with Other Side Entertainment's previous partnership with Starbreeze AB.
And a story that we have covered extensively.
That's all
police
of that.
Raids and lawsuits and CFO malfeasance. And
if you want to go and read that harrowing story, there is a ton of coverage over on GameDaily.biz, which is now being run by our dear friend Sam Desitoff. But yeah, we'll put a link to that particular article talking about when Starbreeze ended up selling back publishing rights for System Shock 3 back to Other Side Entertainment. So, according to Other Side Entertainment, this was both on their Twitter and on their website, this is a direct quote, "We are happy to announce that Tencent," yes, that Tencent, "will be taking the System Shock franchise forward. As a smaller indie studio, it had been challenging for us to carry the project on our own. We believe Tencent's deep capabilities and expertise as a leading game company will bring the franchise to new heights."
All right. This is literally all we have at this point.
There's nothing else out there.
And that statement can be parsed a couple of different ways.
Yes.
And depends on what you focus on. There is one school of thought, based on some of the buzz I saw today, that Other Side is stepping away from it entirely. But they use the words, and this is kind of the counter to that, had been challenging for us to carry the project on our own. So is this a partnership?
It seems, well, I mean, they definitely have outright purchased the IP, from what I understand. Okay. I don't think that they're publishing it. The problem is that there's very, very little in terms of actual information about this, and we haven't seen hide nor hair of Warren Spector in like a year and a half.
Yeah.
So it's challenging because we don't really know what's going on there. So back in February of 2019, the interim CEO at Starbreeze, Mikhail Nirmark, said that, quote, "I believe this is the best solution for us, although it is sad that we cannot complete the project with Otherside. System Shock 3 is a fantastic title developed in cooperation with industry legend Warren Spector, and I'm looking forward to seeing the game released."
So this was, Starbreeze was in a massive deaccessioning phase because they were in severe financial trouble. They've gone through a restructuring.
Twice.
I am not convinced that they're out of the woods yet. Well, that remains to be seen, but they sold off as many of their agreements and publishing deals as they possibly could, or just outright cut them. They were also supposed to be publishing Psychonauts 2.
They were, and they ended up selling those rights to Microsoft. Mm-hmm.
Along with when Double Fine came over and joined Microsoft Studios.
It was really...
Or Xbox Game Studios now.
Yes, I think it's... Is it Xbox Game Studios?
Yes.
I think we determined that. Yes. Yeah, I think we determined that last week. So... System Shock 3 was being developed under license from Vancouver-based Night Dive Studios, which actually owns the rights to the System Shock franchise. I don't know who owns the rights now. Is it Tencent? Is Tencent doing the publishing? We don't actually have a press release that says anything.
Right. Or is this a case of Tencent making an investment in Otherside or purchasing Otherside? There are so many possible permutations of this that for us to speculate...
Wouldn't be responsible.
We're just kind of laying out what could be happening. We're eager to learn.
Yes.
We sure would love to know.
So we're going to be keeping an eye on this. I'm a big fan of the System Shock franchise personally, so it'll be interesting to see how this particular partnership, outright purchase, investment, deal, I don't even know anymore. Whatever form this takes, it'll be really great to see how it ends up affecting the future development of System Shock 3, which I'm assuming is still many years away.
Yeah.
Whew. Ooh, that was tough. And like, talking about Starbreeze is so hard because, you know, they published Dead by Daylight. That was the original publisher. And after that publishing deal completed, it's like everything took a nosedive for Starbreeze after that.
They've essentially got payday at this point.
Yep, Payday is their only franchise as far as I know. They may have one other one, but I don't think so. I think that they sold off literally everything else. And again, if you want to go and read that really sad tale, you know, Game Daily covered it extensively up until my departure in November 2019.
Yeah. Flipping things over onto some positive news.
Woohoo! Ooh. We're going to talk about Animal Crossing.
We are, briefly.
I love talking about Animal Crossing.
Because otherwise we'll get sucked in. There was a lot of speculation about how well Animal Crossing was doing digitally. Nintendo did actually confirm that 50% of sales for Animal Crossing New Horizons were digital.
That's not surprising, considering that we were, at that point, heading into that Amazon, Target, Best Buy, whatever distribution crunch of how do I get my physical game.
Indeed. Nintendo also warned of Switch shortages, although watching our good friend Wario64, who always posts when things come in and out of stock, we've seen over the past couple days, especially Switch stock coming in and out on a number of major retailers. So hopefully that channel is starting to normalize just a little bit. Additionally, Nintendo warned that there may be some software delays due to remote work,
which is all stuff that we covered in their financials last week. This is all stuff that was in there, that was in the document.
Yes. Now we know that Nintendo isn't doing an E3 adjacent or digital E3 adjacent or whatever you want to call. They're not doing a big Nintendo Direct like they normally would.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they just dropped the announcement for Paper Mario Origami King out of nowhere. Now, that's something we would normally expected to be on a Nintendo Direct. So I'm curious, because they can't get together, they can't get into a studio, are we not going to see a Nintendo Direct for a while?
I think that that's probably going to be the case, because as I was saying last week, where do they have the space in their personal homes? I mean, like, Japan, that's not a lot of space, and a lot of these apartments are cramped and tiny, mm-hmm. and even the houses are smaller. So it's just supposed to be for living, not working.
Right. Now, here's the thing. I don't think Nintendo is going to be hurt by having to announce a major game in the way they did, just out of nowhere. Where it's going to hurt is you have a lot of indie titles that are announced or re-promoted on a Nintendo.
During indies.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's where things are going to hurt. We're going to see a lot of independent developers that are going to be releasing on Switch that aren't going to get that lift that they normally would. So, you know, hopefully... We know that, and I want to just give a quick plug here to Jeff Grubb, because I know that on his Twitter, which is just at Jeff Grubb, he has been compiling a full calendar of when all of these multiple press conferences are going to be. There was another one, the New Game Plus event was just announced, and that was a lot of Japanese developers.
Are going to be indies in there as well.
Yeah, Inti Creates and Grasshopper and I think Arc System Works. Yeah. It's Idea Factory. Like, it's a lot of Japanese developers.
Yeah, so
and
I think...
publishers.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that...
I think Gung Ho is in there.
That would make sense. I think that there's a lot to be said for how con season is going to end up this fragmented mess, but hopefully by having these presentations at all... the best games are still going to be signal boosted. I worry so much about the indies
because
you know, these conventions are so important. They're so important for FaceTime and Nindies especially, man. Like, that's become a staple of what I get excited about when I'm watching a Nintendo Direct, is they give me an update on what's going on with their indie portfolio. It's my heart's broken.
I love Nintendo Direct so much more now that I'm not writing while I'm watching them. They are so intense. There's so much information. They're very hard to cover. But I absolutely love watching them. So I'm looking forward to their return. We do have one more piece of Nintendo news.
We do. And we got a lot of legal stuff going on.
We have a lot of legal stuff going on.
Yeah, so buckle up, for this is heavy on the legal stuff. So there was a filed lawsuit against Switch hackers. That's not unusual. Nintendo is fairly litigious and, you know, waves its legal arm fairly frequently. So this first lawsuit was filed Friday. So Friday, May 15th, in an Ohio court against Tom Diltz Jr., the alleged operator of the website Uber Chips.
They do not deliver potato chips to you.
Oh, now I want potato chips.
Just call Uber Eats.
No, I don't want to call Uber Eats. I'll just bribe James to go get me potato chips. Oh, wait, no, we have Sun Chips downstairs. Oh, I'm getting off track. The second lawsuit was filed in a Seattle court that same day against a number of anonymous defendants from a selection of websites. All of these defendants reportedly sell products from a group of anonymous hackers called Team...
Executor?
Yeah. Zecuter?
Zecute.
Zecuter.
Zecuter. No,
Zecuters.
It's got to be Executor.
I think it's Executor, too. Nintendo's lawyers described the products as, quote, an unauthorized operating system and accompanying piracy tools that install it. So this is an interesting one, because, like, this comes back to the discussion that you and I have had over the years about ROMs.
Yes.
And this feels like it's heading in that direction.
Well,
right?
it does, and Nintendo has a successful history of beating down ROM sites.
Yeah, absolutely.
In 2018, they filed a similar lawsuit against a Team Executor hack reseller. January, they won an injunction against the defendant of that case, Sergio Maharo Moreno, who was ordered to stop reselling the hacks. And likewise, Nintendo filed a lawsuit in September 2019 against a ROM website called ROM Universe, which allows people to download pirated video games.
Yeah, we covered that over on Game Daily. I remember that story. That was a bit of an in the weeds legal story for us.
And, you know, there is obviously a conversation to be had about what should and should not be legal in terms of abandonware.
Sure, absolutely.
If you can't purchase it anywhere, should you be able to download it? What does it mean to have something available for preservation? Does preservation mean that it's available to the public? No, it does not.
No, it does
not. It means available for academic study, but that's a completely different conversation.
It really is. And I'm actually working with a video game preservation nonprofit these days on my off hours. What are off hours?
I don't know right now for us, like... Time is a flat circle.
Time is a social construct.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, preservation does not mean that it's available to the public. It means that it sits on servers and it's secured and, you know, there's a lot of like legalese that needs to go around that. So what ultimately this is culminated in is Nintendo is seeking a $2,500 per trafficking violation in each of these cases, as well as a permanent injunction to stop operations of these websites. Mike, what do they mean by per trafficking violation?
So if you are a retailer and you are selling one of these hack devices, that is a single violation.
Ouch.
Yeah, that could add up real fast.
That's going to be an ouchie.
Yeah. So look, again, I believe that there is a conversation to be had about what should happen when software cannot be legally purchased.
Sure, but that's not a conversation for us to have.
No,
that's
it's
a conversation
not.
For a bunch of lawyers to have.
Exactly. But what you do need to know is right now, even if a game is abandoned, if the copyright exists, if you download that game, you're violating someone's copyright.
And therefore it is illegal.
Yes, you can even reasonably make the claim that there is no financial harm done because you couldn't, if you wanted to, purchase this game and then support the original developer or publisher. Fine, you can make that argument, but the way copyright law is, and copyright law, as always, lags behind technology.
Significantly.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, significantly. I think that copyright law is like still back in the 70s or 80s at this point.
So again, that is a conversation for a separate time, but right now the way the law is written...
It's still illegal. And that sucks because there are so many games out there that I've always wanted to play that I never got to play and I can't find them anymore unless I go travel to Maryland and see our good friend Ryan.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's an interesting conversation that we might be able to have in a future show. But, you know, for now, that's what's going on with Nintendo.
Oh, man.
I'm ready for this story.
Okay, so just as a primer... Mike has been following this specific story since before we actually met.
Yeah.
So this has been years and years and years in the making. So I'm going to take a back seat here. I'm just going to ask him some questions if I feel like we need some additional clarification. But Mike is the expert on this particular matter.
And even I, it's been a while, so I had to do some serious refreshing on some of my old stories. And we're not even going to go into the deep dark past on this. Just some of the more recent stuff. So we're going to talk about G2A.
All right, let's do it. Let's jump in.
All right.
Mike, talk to me about what the gray market is.
Oh, the gray market. It's time for term sheet. In this segment, we take a piece of industry jargon, put it in a blender, and make a smooth paste of easily digestible information. Yum.
I need to make this into a t-shirt. I hate it so much.
All right. So first, we need to talk about what G2A is. G2A is a reseller of games, but they're not an authorized reseller. There are authorized resellers out there. Obviously, Steam is a primary storefront. Epic Game Store is a primary storefront. But you have sites like Humble and Fanatical and Green Man Gaming that have relationships with developers and publishers in order to sell their games. They get their codes directly from the source and then sell them. G2A does not do that. So we need to talk about what the gray market is. So the gray market consists of goods sold legally but without the permission of the brand, in this case the developer, the publisher. In the United States, gray market goods are legal, but that doesn't mean they're always ethical. G2A and Kinguin are two of the biggest offenders. Kinguin is a major competitor of G2A. They're the biggest offenders in the gray market game code business. And the big issue with G2A is that a lot of key sellers scam PR representatives out of code. So they email PR pretending to be someone they're not, like a major influencer. And a lot of PR people are wise to this trick by now. They take advantage of cheap Humble bundles. So if you buy a game for as one of four or five games you get for a dollar, wait for that Humble bundle to end and then sell your code under market once the prices go back up. You know, then you're abusing a system there that's designed to help developers, publishers, and charities. And then there's the abuse of giveaways as well. If you spam those free code giveaways, now a lot of sites that do giveaways, they have mechanisms on their website to automate that process. Those can be abused if you're not careful. So those are some of the ways that people gain access to codes illegitimately. And this hurts developers so much that a number of devs, including Mike Rose from No More Robots and Rami Ismail from Vlambeer, they've told people they'd rather see their games pirated than purchased on G2A. Now, here's the problem with G2A. In addition to being a gray market that does damage to developers and publishers, it also functions as a black market. And the way that works is people using the site to sell stolen codes. And there are a couple of different ways that this happens. One is that if there's a security issue, that someone can go in and grab a bunch of codes from a website that's not secure. And that's, we'll talk about this a little bit in a little bit, because that's kind of what happened in this story. Or using stolen credit cards to purchase codes. Also something that happened here. So those codes are, that's selling black market goods. Those aren't legal.
No.
So, this story goes back years, where developers have been really upset at G2A. G2A has defended its business model. It's made little gestures towards the community. It's G2A Shield program, which somehow protects people from accidentally buying stolen codes, or even worse, engaging in stolen Steam gifts. And I'll explain how that works in a little bit. But this piece of the story goes back to last year, to 2019. So first, the first thing that happened, I was reminded of this, G2A tried to get media to post a self-written story, so a blog post, essentially. They went out to media like, hey, we want you to publish this story.
I got that email.
You did?
I did.
Wow. And it was, hey, we want you to publish this thing that we wrote talking about how great we are and how safe our system is and how ethical we are and all that stuff. Also, we want you to not market as sponsored content, which, no, just, would you have ever done that as editor-in-chief of Game Daily?
No, not ever. There have definitely been times where I have received pitches from various places around the internet that have asked me if they can post something on Game Daily, whether or not they wanted me posting it as sponsored content or not. That's not up to them. Nope. They don't get to make that call.
Yep.
The call is made by the ethical standards that that I came up with and that James Brightman came up with when he was editor-in-chief, that we were ethical first. It was the one thing that mattered to us both. Mm-hmm. Ethics always come first. If it's not ethical, we don't do it. If it is great, if it's teetering on the line of being ethical and not ethical, we give it some serious consideration before we go ahead with it. And a lot of the time when it gave us a head scratcher, we decided against it.
Yeah.
We always erred on the side of caution. I received that email and I was disgusted.
Yeah. And larger sites, to be clear, and I think there is a lot of confusion out there, so hopefully this is a chance for us to dispel some of the confusion that exists.
Sure.
In larger organizations, and this happened at Game Informer, I know this happens at VentureBeat, this happens at a lot of major outlets. You have Mashable has this as well.
IGN.
You have separate sponsored content teams from your editorial teams. Editorial doesn't often touch sponsored content. It's written by a different department. It is sold as advertising, and editorial does not have anything to do with it. They sometimes get a heads up that yes. It's happening.
In fact, it's more often than not that editorial will get a heads up. If I had sponsored content that was going up on Game Daily, I would be given a heads up. I would be shown a draft of whatever it was that was going up. There would be the odd time where I would edit it for tone, because it was so wildly wacky and off base for Game Daily that it was like, this doesn't belong on my site. But that was very few and very far between. In fact, I can only think of like two instances where I had to do that out of all of the sponsored content that we had on Game mm-hmm. Daily. It was always handled by the marketing department. And I know for a fact that there are separate sales divisions. And it's important to recognize that this is not an advertorial or whatever division. This is a sales division.
Yes.
This is sold as advertising. Sponsored content is still important. It's important to keep the doors open at a lot of places. I know it was important for Game Daily, but it is not an opportunity to lie and say, oh, hey, this is definitely not purchased. We saw one of the most egregious errors of not marking sponsored content on Teen Vogue.
Yeah, that was a Facebook story.
It was a glowing Facebook story on an outlet that had been notoriously critical of Facebook and notoriously critical of Facebook's policies. So it was really shocking. And that was sponsored content that was not marked properly, which I think was a mistake. I'm hoping that it was a mistake. But sponsored content is such an important avenue of funding for a lot of outlets but it blurs the lines. Mm-hmm. It's blurring the lines between what is considered advertising and what is considered editorial. That's why it's called advertorial now. Yeah.
I think that it's safe to say, and I have some very strong opinions about this, that if you are lying to your readership about what is or isn't sponsored content, if you are erasing that tag from a story, and it should have one because it is sponsored content, you took money for it, you took some kind of consideration for running that story, and you don't clearly, boldly, openly, and even proudly display, like, hey, yeah, our sales team secured this. If you are hiding that from your readership, you don't deserve your readership. Your readership has no reason to trust you if that's the way you do business.
That's a bold statement. Mm-hmm. That's a bold statement. And it's certainly something that I thought long and hard about any time that I was put in an ethical quandary. Ethics is the most important thing to me. And if I don't follow my gut, then I had no reason, I had no right to be at the helm of a site at all.
So why are we talking about this? Because it's important to understand who G2A is before we start talking about
what G2A did.
Yes. So there is a way to sell Steam gifts. Now, if you get a gifted copy of a game, it sits in your inventory. Now, Steam has gotten really good, or better anyway, in the past couple of years about separating out currencies when there are wild discrepancies between how a game is priced on different markets. And there was a way to take advantage of buying a game on, for instance, an Eastern European storefront, mm-hmm. and using an Eastern European currency, and then flipping that game through Steam Gifts in the North American currency, whether that is American dollars or Canadian dollars or pounds or euros. And it was really manipulating the currency, the exchange rates.
Never have thought to do that, by the way. That just, it's Machiavellian almost.
So this is what I wrote in my Game Daily story about this. A Steam gift purchased on G2A requires, quote, a special website to transfer ownership from the seller to the buyer as a way to circumvent Steam's policies around gifting to and from some regions. So what you have to do is you have to go to a separate website, put your login information, then someone else logs into your account. It's dangerous, first of all. Don't ever do this. You're running the risk of losing your account to someone who has nefarious intent. So what's happening is these sellers are purchasing games in regions where the absolute cost is lower than the targeted sales regions, for instance, purchasing in Eastern Europe and selling in North America. If violations of Steam's terms of service around gifting are violated, developers are authorized to revoke those keys, and that requires the fraud to be detected. The other way is, of course, if keys are purchased with stolen credit cards, and then the person who owns that credit card contests the charges and closes the account and says, hey, this is fraud, then the developers end up losing that money in what's called a chargeback. Yep. So G2A proposed a key blocking tool, and it also boldly said it would reimburse developers and publishers 10 times the chargeback cost if stolen keys were detected. And devs laughed at it because it required handing G2A a list of codes to check against.
Oh,
and
boy.
Nobody trusts them.
No, literally no one.
Except for one developer.
Well, let's talk about that developer.
Yeah, Woob Software, developer of Factorio, took them up on it.
That's really strange.
Yeah.
Like, kind of amazing, but also really strange.
Yeah.
So, from what we've gathered about this particular story, the chargebacks cost, what,
$20? $20 or so. Again, what's happening is someone is buying a game with a stolen credit card, and then those charges are being reversed, and the developer is still out the game.
Yeah, they're
out. And they have to pay the money back.
Yeah, exactly. So Whoop estimated that there were $6,600 in stolen code chargebacks. It was close to this. It turns out that it was $6,420. Of the 321 queried codes, G2A handled 198.
Yes.
So G2A is now paying Woob $39,600, 10 times the chargeback fees related to keys traced back to G2A.
Yeah.
That is one developer.
One developer. And again, so what happened about those other, 123 codes? They could have been sold on Kinguin. Or yeah. Another gray/black market seller.
Sure.
So those codes were likely stolen, sold illegitimately. They just weren't sold through G2A.
Yeah.
Reminder, G2A is not the only organization doing this. They're just the most notorious.
Notorious is definitely a good word for them.
So they owed, per their guarantee, they owed 10 times back on the, so that's 198 codes, whatever those chargebacks cost for those 198 codes, and then 10 times that. Now, G2A had originally promised that it was going to use an independent auditor, and in fact, they talked to the big four, which is PricewaterhouseCooper, Ernst & Young, KPMG, and Deloitte & Touche. However, those agencies, those organizations, and other auditors actually have it as part of their arrangement with a client that they are not allowed to publicly disclose the results of an audit. And I wonder if that's something that stems from the Arthur Andersen. Remember, it used to be Big Five. And I did temp work at Arthur Andersen right before everything fell apart with the Enron scandal.
Oh boy, that's definitely a blast from the past.
Yeah. So they agreed on an internal audit.
Okay. So, but what was the worst part of this, though? What's the worst part of this audit?
Okay. So we talk a lot about how organizations like G2A manipulate data for their own ends.
Of course.
So there were 198 codes from this developer that were determined to have been sold illegitimately.
Mm-hmm.
Right? G2A is turning around and saying, well, that just means out of all of the thousands upon thousands of codes we've sold, only 198 were bad. So it's a micro percentage of all the codes, which of course is a ridiculous way to look at the data, because this is one developer. Now, if we had every publisher, and remember, Woob is small. Factorio is one game from a smaller developer.
Yeah.
If Activision 2K, if the big guys decided to engage G2A in this, and for them, I don't know that it's worth it.
It isn't. I sincerely doubt it.
We would find out that those numbers are significantly bigger. So G2A doing a victory lap about this seems silly.
It's not even just silly. It's completely bonkers. Like, it's maddening that they're able to take this and be like, oh, we're going to put a positive spin on it. No, it just means that one developer out of thousands and thousands of developers took you up on your offer because you were hurting them significantly.
Yes. And they won.
I mean, really, like, I'm so happy for Woob. I'm really glad that they got that money. But, oh my goodness, 198 is not a victory lap. It means that you've done the work a micro percentage of the work.
I mean, the nicest thing I can say about G2A in this whole situation is they didn't welch on the deal.
I guess that's okay. Yeah.
So there's a way to fix this, though. And I think this is a topic we can dive into more in depth in a later episode. But it's important to note that there was an announcement in the past week. Uplay has been doing this for a while. Yes. And now Epic has an arrangement with Green Man Gaming, Fanatical, and Genba Digital to do keyless purchase redemption. And I just recently did one of these.
Mm-hmm.
There was that huge deal on Assassin's Creed Odyssey.
Yes.
So the way that worked was I think I purchased that from Fanatical. I think that's where it was on the huge deal. Mm-hmm. And I had to link my Uplay account to it. Again, just like you would link your Facebook account for login stuff, or link your Steam account, or you link, if you have a Twitch Prime and you get some of the freebies, you have to link your accounts in order to get it. Completely safe.
It's the same thing on Humble. Humble links to your Steam profile and you can actually directly redeem it.
Right, but that's
still not
keyless. Right, it's not keyless. There's still a key there. So what ends up happening is you just make the purchase with your account linked, and it shows up in your account. There's no key to sell. There's no way to sell it. It will absolutely, when everybody shifts to keyless, and Steam is, I think if Steam were to ever shift to keyless, that would be the nail in G2A and Kinguin's coffin at that point.
Well, because there would be no way to do the work, to do the shady work that they're doing.
Yeah, I think you could still get away with Steam gifts if there was still a way to do that. Because remember, I can gift you a game and you don't actually have to redeem it into your account. You can just claim it, right?
I guess. I don't know. I've never not actually redeemed a gift because every single time I get a gift, it's a game I really want.
Right. I mean, again, this whole system, like the gifting system is great. There is a lot of, I think what this story tells us as we revisit it, is that there's a lot of abuse, lot of room for abuse in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, G2A had to pay out.
It's not enough money.
Not enough money, but we know now that if one developer was able to prove it, a small developer, this gives us an idea of, like, there is a seedy underbelly to G2A, and it wasn't that hidden. Because we've been talking about this for at least 5 years.
Yeah, exactly. It's so infuriating.
Yeah, this goes back to Tiny Build, right? Tiny Build going.
Seriously,
and
yeah.
And then Rami and Mike Bithell going after, they were sitting at the G2A presentation.
I remember.
At an event in Europe. I can't remember which event it was.
I don't know.
I don't know if it was EGX or...
It wasn't Reboot Develop, I don't think.
I don't think so. But it was really funny because there were a bunch of stories that kind of popped up out of that. But developers are not shy about telling G2A exactly what they think of them.
Yeah, they're definitely... Well, yeah. I think lots of people are not too shy about it because it ruins the industry.
Yeah.
And it really hurts developers, especially small developers.
It does.
So G2A sucks.
Yeah. But you know what doesn't suck?
Minecraft.
Minecraft does not suck.
Minecraft does not suck. Also, Mojang?
I think it's Mojang.
I think it's Mojang as well. They have a slightly new name. Apparently, they are now Mojang. I think it's Mojang. Studios. They have a studios there.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Even cooler than that, though, is Minecraft has now sold more than 200 million copies. And they hit their 100 million 4 years ago in 2016.
So they've sold another 100 million copies in 4 years.
Like, that's amazing. It's utterly incredible. But to me, the real testament to Minecraft's power is in their monthly active users. You know me.
Mm-hmm.
I always want to know what the DAUs look like and the MAUs look like. Give me those numbers. Their monthly active users on Minecraft, this was a very, very recent statistic. Mm-hmm. They're sitting at 126 million players. So let's look at this. Almost all of the people that purchased a copy of Minecraft are still monthly active users.
Yep. I want to put this another way, and we'll talk about this more on the earnings show.
Yeah.
There are 130 million copies of Grand Theft Auto V that have been sold at this point. And not all of them are playing. I have purchased that game, I think, 3 times. And I'm certainly not playing right now.
I purchased it the one time. And by purchased, I mean I redeemed it on the Epic Game Store.
Oh, well, there you go. We'll talk about that tomorrow. But there are 130 million copies. We know the monthlies are significantly lower than that. There are almost as many monthly users of Minecraft as people who totally purchased GTA 5.
You're getting those mixed up today.
I am. My brain is Swiss cheese.
It's Thursday.
But yeah, and GTA 5... is an enormous seller. So just like putting that into comparison about how powerful Minecraft is.
Minecraft is an incredible, incredible game. And actually, if you want to listen to a podcast that I was on where I talked about games as a playground for children, especially preteens, I sat down with my frequent podcast partner, Steve Dutzman, on the Engaged Family Gaming Show, and we had an extensive conversation about that, and that'll go live tomorrow.
Excellent. Definitely give that a listen.
So
let's talk about recent though. Like 126 million monthly users. Okay, great. What's happened like in the last month?
So April brought in a 25% increase in new users, which is not super surprising, but a 40% spike in multiplayer sessions. Okay, so let's break that down for a second. The multiplayer sessions are playing with people that are either in your house,
mm-hmm.
so you're playing it, you know, on the same server, mm-hmm. or you're playing with your friends that are not in your house.
Yep.
So this is like the kiddo equivalent of playing an MMO, like playing Final Fantasy 14 with your friends or playing Fortnite with your friends or whatever. 40% spike in multiplayer.
I think we're seeing that this is how kids are hanging out.
They don't have anything else right now. And I mean, like, Gabriel, our youngest son, is constantly in, like, daily calls with his friends on Zoom just to set up, like, these digital play dates so they can get on Minecraft.
Oh, they are? That's great.
Like, that's the whole reason why they're doing this. So they're setting up, like, their friend lists and everything like that, and they're going to continue to talk, like, on FaceTime and stuff like that because their accounts are reasonably locked down for their age. Mm-hmm. They are young. You know, our youngest son is turning 9 this year. He's not old enough to be playing games online with people that he doesn't know. And so we've locked down all multiplayer access for him on PlayStation and on basically every other network that he has. this is so amazing. I'm so happy for the kids that are able to hang out with their friends. I mean, what Steven and I talked about last night is like these kids don't really have anything else right now. Their buddies don't have phones. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Gabe and his friends don't have phones. They've got their computers.
And they have their iPads.
Well, I mean, Gabe has an iPad, but not all of his friends do. Right? They have laptops because they have to do virtual schooling now. So, 40% spike in multiplayer sessions. It's so exciting.
And Minecraft, I mean, I have played some Minecraft. I'm not diehard.
I've played a lot of Minecraft.
I love, and I sat in on the NVIDIA ray tracing demo. Like, I haven't loaded that up yet. I'm really excited to do that. But the thing I'm super excited for as a huge action RPG fan, next week, Minecraft Dungeons.
Yeah, we're going to have to play the utter living heck out of that game.
And I kind of want to buy it on Switch, but I have Game Pass, so I'll have it on PC, and we'll have it on Xbox One.
Totally.
And there's going to be crossplay. Yeah. So we could get the entire family in on that very easily.
I think that's brilliant. I'm way into it. Give me Minecraft Dungeons. Ben Cachero was saying how much he loved Minecraft Dungeons. He and I were talking on, like, replying back and forth on that on Twitter for a little while, where I'm just like, Ben, put it in my veins.
Yeah.
In my veins right now.
I
love ARPGs so much.
Cool. So that's Minecraft. A couple of little notes coming out of EA about two of their bigger games.
Yep.
One of them, Anthem.
Yeah. Oh, Anthem. God, we were so hype about Anthem, Mike.
I love the traversal in Anthem still feels better than almost any other game I've played.
I think that it is probably the most successful usage of flying in a game I've ever played. And I played Aeon.
Mm-hmm.
And Aeon had some kick-ass flying. It really did. Was it Aeon or Terra? Might have been both. I don't know. I've played a lot of MMOs in my time. They all kind of bleed together at a certain point. But yeah, man, that flight in that game felt so good, but it was really repetitive, and it was beautiful, but it was meaningless in so many ways. So anyway, BioWare is trying to figure out, you know, what went wrong with Anthem. What's the next steps for Anthem?
So we knew that they were going to be taking a hard look at it.
Yeah.
There was an update posted from Christian Daly, who is the studio director of BioWare Austin. They have a small team for EA, so 30 people, who are now kind of investigating, and they've been trying to figure out what happened. So it's early yet. I had heard from sources that we're looking at 2021 before we see Anthem 2.0.
Are we going to see like a Realm Reborn kind of situation?
I think it would be smart for them to do that. I think there's...
And for our listeners that don't know, Final Fantasy XIV did not start off as the powerhouse MMO that it is today. It was a mess at the beginning. I didn't play at the beginning. I only played a Realm Reborn, but it was an utter calamitous mess. And it's turned into this jewel of an MMO.
Yeah, and I don't play MMOs, and I am a huge Final Fantasy XIV fan. And there are people I know who are huge MMO fans, like Manda, who are huge Final Fantasy XIV fans. It has broader appeal than a lot of MMOs because there's so many good quality of life things in there.
But that's neither here nor there. The important thing is that it was a completely rebooted system. Mm-hmm. It was taken down to its studs by the developers, and they built it back up based on feedback from the community and their own instincts as to what would make an incredible gaming experience. They wanted to save Final Fantasy XIV because Eorzea is such an interesting, it's such an interesting place to go on adventures.
It is.
I want an Anthem 2.0 so bad.
Me too. And I would love to see them go the route of what happened with Diablo 3 and what happened
was also a complete disaster at launch. Yeah. I couldn't play it. It was an unplayable mess.
And there are some problems.
Unless you played single player.
We could talk extensively about the challenges that I saw in Anthem's design that were like those cliffs that people fall off of, right?
Yeah, for sure. But I think that if we're going to do that, we should get some designers in to have a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Like these are just things I've noticed as a player. But we're not going to talk about that so much as they have what they're calling an incubation team. So they're purposely keeping it small. And what they're starting to validate our design hypothesis. So they've gone through the redesign process. Mm-hmm. And now they are experimenting and prototyping on those design things. They are taking this game down to its studs and rebuilding it. That excites me. I don't think I'm an Anthem apologist other than I am someone who sees the potential in that world. I'm someone who sees the potential in that traversal system. There was a lot of customization.
I loved the customization. The materials customization, I think, was probably one of my favorite customization qualities in a game that has max.
Yeah, and that was really smart. And being able to unlock more of those materials and unlock like the different, like, it's dirty, now it's standard, now it's shiny brand new as you progress through the game.
How would you make it dirty?
I don't know. Maybe you like that lived-in look for your javelin.
I don't understand. Yep. I just like shiny things.
Yeah, so I'm excited to see what happens, but again, we're not going to see it anytime soon.
No.
I would expect that...
2 more years, probably.
Yeah, I think that what we're going to see is there's going to be a big push around it that includes some kind of Xbox Series X, PlayStation 5, if you own it on one of those, you know, if you own it on one of the current systems, they're gonna have to figure a way to carry people over, because the last thing you want to do, you're not gonna want anybody to have to double dip who was there at the beginning.
No,
you gotta treat those people right.
You gotta treat those people like the royalty they should be to your community, because they were early adopters. I know you and I got in good with that game, and I'm like you. I love to see what happens with live service games that aren't great out of the gate, because it just gives so much more wiggle room to creativity. And it sucks that it fell down so flat, and it sucks that, you know, I'm such a big BioWare fan, and, like, I felt personally let down, but I'm also one of those kinds of people where the possibility space is a place I love living in anyway, so I'm gonna go live in my little cloud, and I'm gonna think about Anthem some more, and think about all the cool ways that they could make Anthem amazing, not just for a group, but for a single person.
And what I will say for EA on this one is Star Wars Battlefront 2 launched in a very challenging state because of the way the MTX was implemented.
Yeah, the loot box situation was extremely damaging.
So that game, and which has now, I believe, had its final update.
Yeah.
And has come so far and is so, so good. It didn't, you know, so EA has now pulled off that Square Enix Final Fantasy XIV turnaround, that Blizzard Diablo 3 turnaround.
Well, but the big difference there being, of course, is that the game's mechanics were already very solid. And Anthem's mechanics are a little shakier.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep, like all that said, we're going to keep our eye on this. We're excited for this incubator to see what's going to happen for, you know, an Anthem 2.0 or whatever the heck the end of Anthem Realm Reborn. I don't know. Who even knows anymore? But what else is going on with EA?
One other thing, Respawn has said it's not working on a new Titanfall right now, which is a bit of a shift from what they hinted at.
They did.
Last year.
Personal heartbreak.
You know, we talked about John Shearing and Drew McCoy leaving and forming their own studio last week.
Were heavy contributors on Titanfall.
Yes. And we've talked about the success of Apex.
Yep.
We've also talked about the success of Jedi Fallen Order. And it could be that with Apex in full swing and, you know, it dipped a bit after launch, but it now has established itself really well.
It's in its fifth season right now and is, I think, season five has been fairly well received universally.
So they've done, even with their very different cadence from Fortnite, because they were operating on a monthly cadence as opposed to Fortnite's regular iteration.
They also have a much smaller team.
They do, yeah. And, you know, obviously Jedi Fallen Order doing really well. I expect that we're going to see more out of them because, you know, that was, what it was, a 10 million, I believe? It was
10 million.
So that's nothing to shake a stick at.
That's a solid single player opening.
Yep.
It really, really is.
And, you know, it's not 10 million that's going to be monetized like a service game, but that's still a great Star Wars game released by EA when they needed a great Star Wars game because of how Battlefront 2 launched.
Sure, and they needed a great single-player cinematic experience, really, if we really want to talk about it. I know we're trying to get away from saying, like, games as cinema, but still.
It just needs fast travel. Just, please, fast travel.
Yeah.
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 So that's EA.
I'm really sad about no Titanfall. Titanfall 2 is legitimately one of my favorite FPS games of all time.
That game also, I think, launched a week after a Battlefield. Was it Battlefield 1 it launched right after?
It might have been, yeah.
And, you know, releasing both of those games in such close quarters, I think, didn't do Titanfall any service.
It's really sad, too, because Titanfall was the superior game. Mm-hmm. Titanfall 2 was just... We want to talk about traversal.
Oh, yeah.
We want to talk about how solid... Like, parkour in a friggin' mech? Like, come on. Like, come on. It's so good. And the story was brilliant, so... I'm kind of sad that they don't have a Titanfall 3 in development.
Yeah.
Or a Titanfall adjacent game in development.
Maybe we'll see that once we're into next gen, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
I'll be there for it.
Yes, I will be, once again, putting my arm out and saying, please put this directly into my veins. I am a huge Titanfall fan.
Nice. And that brings us to our last story, yet another lawsuit. We told you this one was going to be full of lawsuits and legal wranglings and stuff.
All right, so what's going on? We have a lawsuit from Ubisoft. So, Mike, lay it out for us.
So, Ubisoft has sued Apple and Google.
What?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I'm glad you asked.
Okay.
You might have heard of this game called Rainbow Six Siege.
I've never definitely heard about that game every single day.
Also, another instance of a game not launching terribly well and then really building and evolving and responding to its community. Again, that's Ubisoft. We've seen them do this a bunch of times.
Yeah, but this isn't just any game. This is an esports darling.
It is. Rainbow Six is kind of a big deal. Rainbow Six Siege
is a huge deal in esports.
So there is a game released by a company, I believe they're in China, called eJoy, called Area F2.
Okay.
That looks a little bit like Rainbow Six Siege.
I think it looks more like Rainbow Six Siege than Ubisoft was comfortable with. In fact, Ubisoft described it as a, quote, near-carbon copy that is designed to, quote, piggyback on the success of Rainbow Six Siege. Woof.
Yeah.
Okay, we got some additional context
We did. And before we get into what Ethan had to say, I just want to remind people that you cannot protect game mechanics.
No, it's important to remember that game mechanics cannot be copyrighted.
Copyrighted, patented, trademarked.
Any of those things.
You can't do a ritual over them to make sure nobody copies them because
there's nothing saying that you can't do any rituals. You're not in people's houses or development studios. You don't know what they do on their off time.
Okay, all right.
We're not condemning your whatever rituals. That's fine. Do what you
want. So you can protect art assets, you can protect sound, you can protect names. You can't protect the way a game plays. And if you could, nobody would be able to jump in a video game or aim down the sights or punch somebody. Like, that's the road that takes us. So you can't protect...
And it's a silly place. It's like Camelot.
You can't protect mechanics and ideas. Yes, it's very silly.
It's like Camelot. Very silly place.
But you can protect the art assets, the sound, all of that stuff.
Right. So... What did Ethan Jacobs have to say? Our dear friend who works in intellectual property law.
Yes, Ethan Jacobs of Holland Law reached out to him. And when he said at first glance, this case looks like a clone of another clone case, PUBG versus NetEase. Now, NetEase had a game called Knives Out, or has a game called Knives Out.
And there's another one. And it's an extremely successful game. Yeah,
there's another. They actually have two different Battle Royale, like photorealistic Battle Royale games. I can't remember what the other one is, but
Knives Out consistently is on the top of the charts, though. Like, Knives Out isn't just a tiny thing. It's a huge deal, especially in China.
Yeah, and I think the situation was NetEase released both of these games that were slightly different with two different names and figured, we're going to A-B test this stuff, and we'll sunset the one that doesn't work, and we'll just promote the one that does. So Knives Out did well. So PUBG Corp sued NetEase, and they said, oh, the roofs of the house look different, like, look the same, and the gameplay's the same. I think there was a frying pan in Knives Out or something like that.
But were there any chicken dinners? Could you be a winner chicken dinner?
There was something about that, I think. It was
convoluted.
Yes. So what Ethan said was, one difference in this case is that Ubisoft has only brought a copyright infringement claim and not, as PUBG did, claims for trademark infringement and unfair competition.
It's not the first time PUBG Corp had brought an unfair competition lawsuit out, by the way.
Oh, yeah, there was that whole Fortnite thing.
Yeah, which we covered, again, if you want to go read whatever the heck happened with that, that's over on Game Daily as well. We covered that extensively. Yeah.
The other thing that Ethan says is that Rainbow Six Siege has a lot more, quote, shape to it than PUBG does. Mm-hmm. Characters that do specific things.
Yes.
Maps.
Yeah.
And yeah, more maps. And remember, PUBG, I think, has like two or three maps now, those big maps.
I don't know. I don't play PUBG.
Yeah, but Rainbow Six has many more maps than that.
Yes, they do. Well, a lot of their stuff is like all inside, isn't it? Like, yeah. Isn't that the point of Rainbow Six Siege?
It's close quarters, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and graphic design and the interface. So it'll make the copyright analysis more interesting. Unfortunately for Ubisoft, it still will face the obstacle that most of what's been copied isn't protectable. Game rules and game objects that look like real-world objects. I need to think carefully about whether anything alleged in the complaint could be protectable, because if there is something, it's buried in a pile of plainly unprotectable details.
So basically what we're saying is that it is a mixed legal bag.
Yes. And then...
No, so, and then.
Oh, yes, and then in this case.
No, and then. Okay, so anyway, the and then is that Ejoy did respond and pulled down Area F2 almost immediately.
Yes, they gave their community mere hours of warning, saying that they were, quote, carrying out improvements to the game.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the other piece of this is, quote, the steep learning curve resulted in many players abandoning the game in less than 30 minutes, and the reasons given include not knowing what to do, not knowing where the targets or their teammates are, and dying without seeing the enemy or knowing what killed them. Okay, so even if this were the case, which might very well be, I don't know, you don't know, neither of us have played Area F2. I don't even play Rainbow Right. Six Siege. I can appreciate it for what it's done for the industry, but it's not my kind of game. So what's the big issue here? This seems like a cover. It seems like a smokescreen.
This is a healthy dose of butt covering. because you don't pull your game, and this is according to them in that same post, you don't pull your game, you fix it.
Yeah.
When you're in the top three in the app stores and free to play.
Yeah.
You have a community, a healthy community.
And you have streamers.
Streamers! You've got people out there promoting your game, and it's like people like your game that you ripped off from somebody else.
Which may or may not be paid sponsorships or whatever. I don't know.
So I went back to Ethan, and this was like the day after. I said, you're never gonna believe this. And he said, well, this is what happens. And I'm paraphrasing Ethan right now. This is what happens when your distributors, in this case Apple and Google, the App Store and the Google Play Store, start twisting your arm because you done wrong. Because, well, they got sued. Now, the other thing is, why would you sue? Because there's Fair Harbor, right? Or Safe Harbor.
There's Safe Harbor.
There's Safe Harbor. Where you don't typically get a chance to sue the storefront or sue the ISP or the distributor. Chances are that Ubisoft did file a takedown request that was denied by both parties.
Yeah.
So I'm sure. That's why they probably turned around and sued Apple and Google. We obviously don't have that.
We don't have the legal documentation there. We do not have that paper trail. So we don't know.
So that was an interesting one that kind of popped up and then went away. I don't know if the lawsuit's going to go away because Ejoy did make money off this.
Yeah, I don't know, like, how long was Area F2 actually available for?
I don't know.
That's the real question. We'll close the loop on that for when we talk next time, but that's it.
That's the news show!
Oh my god.
That's... We have another podcast to record right after this.
We do. Okay, but this has been episode 21?
I'm scrolling back to the top. It takes a while. Episode 21, which we're calling Legal Beagles.
Excellent. Well, thank you for...
We're more dog than eagle.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's probably true. We are very loyal. And you are very fluffy.
I am.
Good times. Thanks for listening to episode 21 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @virtualeconcast. I'm Amanda at Amanda Farrow.
And I'm at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. You can also subscribe to our RSS feed. If this is your first time here, welcome. You can subscribe and get our episodes hot dropped into your RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on your favorite podcast delivery service, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, Podcastification. Oh my gosh, it's a podcast. I'm making some of these up. They might exist for all I know. Oh my gosh, it's a podcast is my new app.
Wow. I'm really glad that we're launching things for F Squared. Yeah.
So if you are new, please subscribe. We'd love to have you week to week. We've got a couple of shows planned each week. We have an interview. Our last interview was Sean Alexander Allen. We have a new show. We got bonus episodes like the upcoming earnings call, which will be
meaty.
Live tomorrow and meaty. And if you can, please review the show. We'd love to know what you think. You can also drop us some feedback on Twitter or via email at podcast@fsquared.biz, which is also where you can send us questions. We love listener questions. So please send them to us.
Yes, we do like hearing from you. So speaking of which, Virtual Economy is an F Squared initiative. And along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way that we are working to give back to the community. To find out more about F Squared and the services that we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
Yes. FSQUARED.BIZ.
Okay, I'm going to let you do the spelling from now on because it is just too funny to watch your face.
I am here to amuse.
That is fair. It's true. He's my dancing footer. Anyway, we will be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.